Okay, well, good afternoon. Good to see you all. For this second one, I entitled it Part 2, Becoming Sane. I was having trouble figuring out what to call it because I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to say, and I'm still not. But a large part of that is because, you know, there were several people who came up afterwards and said that they had questions that they didn't get a chance to ask. So there may be a ton of questions, and that's what we're going to do. Or you may all go shy and not ask your questions, and then there's some other things I can do. But I do see that there are a few of you here who weren't here last time. So I want to give you the Reader's Digest version of the last talk. Basically, you know, we started researching what the fathers had to say about insanity and demonic possession because people were coming to us asking, you know, am I really schizophrenic or am I possessed? You know, is my son really bipolar or is he possessed? And, you know, you'd ask three people and get six answers, you know, and so we started looking. And pretty much everything we found out really amazed us. And the first point was that the fathers recognized a difference between mental illness and demonic possession, and that, in fact, wasn't anything special to them. At least 300 years before Christ, there was an understanding in Greek medicine of mental illness that had nothing to do with demonic possession. And then the next point was the general attitude that the fathers had towards the mentally ill and the possessed was of compassion. And if they accepted their infirmity with thanksgiving and humility, they actually were to be admired. And St. John Chrysostom is big on this point. You know, one thing I didn't say was that he actually has a series of a long letter of three books to a demon-possessed monk named Stigirius. And he's just, you know, very compassionate to him and basically saying that, you know, it's because you're such a good monk that this has happened to you, you know, which is a total flip from, you know, what we tend to think. Then one of the things that happened, the way we were studying this at the beginning was doing word searches through what the Ante-Nicene Fathers and the Nicene Post-Nicene Fathers, and some of you are nodding and some of you don't know what I'm talking about, but that's okay. So, but anyway, but in going through this, we found that, you know, at more than 9 out of 10 instances of words like insane, mad, beside themselves, frenzied, had nothing whatsoever to do with mental illness or demonic possession. It was, you know, if you're a heretic, you're insane. If you're a pagan, you're insane. If you're a persecutor of Christians, you're insane. If you're a sinning Christian, you're insane. Which basically leaves saints and insane people. And, you know, I know where I am on that particular demarcation, and it's not the saint. And at first, you know, we weren't taking it seriously. It was just, you know, like hyperbole. You know, well, I'll say, oh, isn't that the craziest thing you ever heard? But I don't mean the person's insane. But what happened, you know, is this comes up everywhere. It's like if you have something that a father of the church wrote that's more than a few pages, they're going to call somebody insane. And the ecumenical councils, when they denounce a heretic, they're always saying something about that person's insanity. And the persecutors of Christians, you know, when they'll get in these conversations and they'll tell the Christian, you know, you're insane, you know, look what you're going through, for this God of yours who was crucified, I mean, how crazy is that? And then the Christian, the martyr, would turn back on them and say, no, you're insane. And so either, you know, they're giving these cheap shots at the most inopportune times, or they're just totally serious about the insanity of sin. And so basically, that was the third point, is if you're not a saint, you're insane. And then the fourth point, also shocking, maybe even more shocking, is that you're better off being possessed by a demon than you are by your passions. And the fifth point, just I'll explain those together because I'm just trying to sum up what I said. The reason we're better off being possessed by a demon than by our passions is that possession by passions is a worse form of possession by demons. And it's simply this, is that if I am happily sinning, you know, if I am happily eating too much and, you know, neglecting people who are dying of starvation, if I am happily proud, whatever it is, it's like I am, the demons haven't, you know, come in and broken my door down, I've invited them in. And that's the insanity, and that's why it's so much worse. And so for us, that was just totally eye-opening. You know, it was up to then, we would see somebody who was mentally ill or demon-possessed, and at best, it was sort of this, you know, unfortunately, like this condescending pity. You know, oh, those poor people. And, you know, what we saw was that we're the ones that we need to worry about, not so much them, you know, because if they accept their condition thankfully and humbly, they're really in the position of the strong person who has the hard fight. You know, we're in the position of like the little wimpy guy who can't really get into the fight. So the what we can at least do is, you know, go in and give the person a towel and wipe the blood off their face. And it's a totally different understanding of what our relationship is to the people who are struggling in that way. And if you take it seriously, this is really scary stuff. Because it's like, I'm in worse shape than a demon-possessed person? That's not good. and so how I finished the talk last month was quoting St. John Chrysostom, on the passage in Ephesians about, you know, wrestling not against flesh and blood, but principalities and powers and, you know, that all that. And he says, he that wrestles is still held fast, but it is enough for him that he has not fallen. When we depart hence then, and not till then, will the glorious victory be achieved. For instance, take the case of some evil lust. The extraordinary thing would be not even to entertain it, but to stifle it. If, however, this be not possible, then though we may have to wrestle with it and retain it to the last, yet if we depart still wrestling, we are conquerors. So, you know, those of us who are struggling with our passions, we can take heart. You know, it's not like we're just doomed. We can take heart and continue to fight. And one thing that somebody did ask me that I did want to address in relation to that, there are very few black and white things, and this is not a black and white thing. So it's not like if I'm sinning, it's 100% willful, and I'm a complete, total wreck that there's no hope for. You know, most of us have sins that we would like to get rid of, and honestly, we wouldn't like to get rid of them as much as we ought to like to get rid of them, and that's part of our difficulty that, you know, we need to work on. But there is a point in which the sin sort of takes over in the same way that a demon takes over. And when you're at that point, then, you know, for the sake of humility, it's, okay, here's where I am, and I'm a mess, and at least it can help me be more loving to other people. Because it's like, here, I'm a mess. I've been struggling with this thing for years and years and years and gotten nowhere that I can see. So can I at least be compassionate to the people around me who are struggling And maybe they've been struggling for years and years and years and not getting anywhere that they can see, and certainly nowhere I can see because I'm blind in my sin. So, so basically, that, in a nutshell, is what I had to say last time. Now, some of you who are here mentioned that you had questions. So is there anything that you want to ask in regard to that? Or anything I didn't mention right now? Yes?
So I often work at the mental health hospital.
Right.
And I noticed how some people treat the mentally ill people. I just would like to know would be the proper way. Shall we have, like you said, more condescending, or shall we have deep compassion, or what would be the proper way to treat them?
I would say deep compassion and respect. And, one thing I did mention last time was that, I'm not saying that this is a cure-all kind of thing by any stretch of the imagination, but I've talked with several people who have mental illness, and it was amazing that all they really needed to hear was that they're not second-class citizens in the kingdom of heaven, or that they're maybe not possibly can be a citizen of the kingdom of heaven at all. And, to be able to say, here, you've got this struggle, and it's a hard struggle, and God bless you, keep going, and I'll do what little I can in my feeble little way to help. It's an immensely freeing thing. Mother Victoria, our abbess, she told me a story before we started studying this, and it absolutely mystified me. And what the story was, she had a friend or acquaintance who used to correspond with her, and this woman was a schizophrenic. And she wanted to be a nun, but you don't tonsure a person that you know has a mental illness into becoming a nun or a monk. And the reason isn't because they're not worthy. The reason is they've got so much of a struggle already that it isn't fair to them to give them another struggle on top of the struggle they have. So this woman was a spiritual child of, whose name I just forgot, the one that wrote the Authentic Seal?
Father Emilian.
Father Emilian, yes, thanks. and he, some of you may know who he is, but he was is one of the leading lights of Mount Athos and was very responsible for a renewal that happened there of the depth of spiritual prayer. And so here's this, great light of our times. And here's what he told this woman. He said, you can't become a nun, but your way to God is through your mental illness. And God has given you a harder way than he has given to me. And so when I first heard that, I was like, I don't get this one little bit. But then when we started doing all this study, then it made perfect sense. In a way, one of the hardest things that you can do to somebody is put them in a place where they can't trust their mind. This is my ruler, my yardstick that tells me how I'm doing. And if my yardstick is messed up, then how do I know how I'm doing and how hard it is for a person in that situation? But, in a weird way, that hardest thing is also the great saving grace for a person in that situation. Because, 99 times out of 100, they may be out in left field. But that one time out of 100 that they're not, the one thing they know without a shadow of a doubt is that they're a mess and need help. And the one thing that we spend our whole lives trying to convince ourselves that isn't true is that we're a mess and we need help. And so a person who has to struggle through that kind of a thing is in many ways our better, you know, and in a weird sort of way, it takes a lot of strength to be weak. So I'm not sure if I answered your question.